Thank you for listening to this Podcast One Sportsnet production, available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
Welcome to Real Jam Radio. I'm Danny Lurie, your host, and so happy to have you with us for this episode. I reached out to Lee Jenkins of Sports Illustrated after reading his excellent Giannis piece, which just came out on Tuesday, and he, in typical Lee Jenkins fashion, said, well, how about tomorrow? So we recorded on Wednesday morning about the Giannis piece and a lot of other different topics, the young players in the league, where the sport is going, and we, of course, even get into new topics at the very, very end. Really did enjoy it. Conversation runs about an hour, and this episode is sponsored by ZipRecruiter, a new sponsor to Real Jam Radio. It's a great place to post and find your next job. You can go to ziprecruiter.com/sportsfan and post jobs there for free. And also our friends at Audible, you can go to www.audible.com/try now and you can get a free audiobook with a trial subscription. As I said, the episode runs about an hour. I will have timestamps for this, so if you want to look in the description, you can see what we get into, but as you could guess with a conversation with Lee, it bounces around a little bit. So the timestamps are just a guide. I would highly recommend listening to the whole thing. I hope you enjoy it. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me, Danny. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Good, thanks.
The Giannis piece, which just recently came out, I thought was an interesting one to bring you back on because he is, of course, resonating a lot this year, playing better. And I think one of the parts that I enjoyed the most about your piece is connecting, and he talked about it pretty openly, about how his past connects with his present, not only in terms of like persona or something like that, but just in terms of the way that he approaches basketball and life in general.
Yeah, I mean, it's tough with guys like this because I think the hardcore fans sort of know how compelling his background is, how difficult it was. But you know, you also have sort of more casual fans, readers of the magazine who don't know everything about these guys who probably don't know it. So, you know, it's one of those situations where you want to work it in. You want to kind of, you know, explain what happened with this guy, because even amongst, you know, all these NBA players, so many of whom come from difficult backgrounds, I think Giannis' story sort of stands apart. But you also don't want to repeat it too much, because I think for the Bucks fans and for the people who really know these guys, it is a story that's been told. So, what I tried to do was have him kind of talk about what it meant to him. Because, you know, one thing I've learned about players is, you know, so many of them have these very interesting pasts, and sometimes their presents are actually, what's going on in their lives right now can seem, you know, sort of the same. It's essentially basketball. There are business components, obviously, but their pasts are interesting. So, you know, what I try to do is get them to, you know, try to lead them into conversations about, you know, how it informs their present, what it means to them at a given time, because I think that changes. I think some guys are in spots where they don't, you know, really want to talk about some of those things that happened to them early in life, and then some of them are at places where they do. So I kind of wanted to talk to him since he is sort of on this cusp of superstardom right now. I mean, he really seems to be, you know, crossing over into that place. How he kind of uses his past, whether it's for inspiration. The way I phrased it was actually, you know, some people will kind of put this to the side. You know, that was another time. I'm past that. I've moved on it. And some people use it more as fuel. I mean, this is someone who was very literally selling toys and sunglasses and video games on the street near the Acropolis in Athens in order to make ends meet with his family. That's not something you hear every day, even given as numb as we are to sort of these really rough stories that NBA players often come from.
What I was struck by reading it is that, you know, I'm a CBA nerd. I think a lot about the way that money works in the NBA, both from a structural constraint and everything else. And I've talked before about how one of the changes with there being so much more money in the league with the new television deal is the idea that players can get life-changing money without making their maximum or anything like that. So we're seeing guys sometimes leave money on the table. Actually, his teammate Chris Middleton is a good example of that, where I think he could have gotten more money if he had waited or whatever. But what this story reminded me is that even though the rookie scale when Giannis came into the league was comically low relative to the way the league is supposed to be structured, that's still life-changing money, and it was life-changing money for him. And we lose sight of that sometimes based on the overall paychecks that are there, including the one that he's going to start getting next season.
It's $100 million. He probably left $6 million on the table. That would have been the max. You know, I think he was cognizant of that. The Bucks ownership sort of talked about what that would mean as far as, you know, potentially some future flexibility. But yeah, I mean, for someone like this, I don't really lose sight of that because I try to talk to them enough about, you know, where they were from. And I think for all of these guys, especially someone like this, he feels as though he's hit the lottery. And I mean, you're talking about somebody who at 16 didn't really know what he had, didn't know his physical gifts. We're only 6 years later, and he's a $100 million player. So, you know, he talked a lot about sort of all the generations that set up for him and sort of marveling. I mean, look, right when he got the contract, he called the owner, and the first thing out of his mouth was, thank you for the money. So I think it for a lot of players, I think there's sort of this idea, you know, the posters are on the wall, the Kobe, the Jordan, the LeBron, they're chasing this, they're, you know, chasing the idea of being one of the all-time greats. That's not how it started with this guy. It started financially. This was about taking care of his family, getting them out of a really wretched situation where, you know, it wasn't just that they were impoverished, it was that they lived in the fear of deportation constantly. Every time they left their apartment, they worried they were going to get deported to Nigeria, because obviously they were undocumented immigrants. If the parents get deported, the kids would be deported as well. So even though Giannis was born in Greece. So I think all of those were the initial motivating factors for a guy like this. And then once he gets here and once he sort of sees, you know, what's possible in the NBA, I think that's when sort of these other motivations kick in, which is, you know, I want to be great, I want to be a superstar, I want to make a max. But it wasn't, I don't think it's all financial at this point, obviously. I think now it's more about kind of pursuing greatness within the craft. And it is interesting how, you know, how the way he phrased the work when he was back home, and what he said is basically, that's where I learned how to work. And that's predictable. You know, that's kind of what I expected him to say. The point that resonated a little more with me is that when he was a kid and he would be out there, I mean, I'm talking 7, 8, 9, 10 years old, pounding the pavement, trying to sell this stuff, that the results weren't guaranteed. That he could hustle all day, he would sing Christmas carols to people, he could do all that stuff, and he could still go home without a lot. And I think for him, the most gratifying part of the league, of his place in it, is that when he does the work, he sees the results. I mean, clearly he's seen it in the last few years. This has been a fairly unimpeded developmental course he's been on. I mean, he has developed just like any team would want. There haven't been actually a lot of obstacles or adversities. I know the team struggled, but as far as individually, he's progressed pretty consistently and obviously taken the big leap this year, but progressed pretty consistently. And I think that, I mean, what he said is that's the most fun part of this for him, is that when he does the work, he sees the results. And clearly when you have those kinds of physical gifts, you will.
I don't know if you've read or listened to it yet, but I just finished Trevor Noah's book, which is about growing up in South Africa and everything with that. And he had an amazing analogy in it that I think is really applicable to this. And it was about the idea of class and the idea of where you come from, is that, you know, the old analogy of, you teach a man to fish, you can feed him for a lifetime, give a man a fish. And he said, the problem there is the fishing pole. And I think that part of what works for Giannis is that the fishing pole is just playing basketball really well. And I thought that was fascinating. And also, the other point that I wanted to get into with the same kind of idea is, there's a difference between, like, for me, my interpretation of LeBron's story, Durant's story in particular, those two, who both had tough upbringings in many different ways, you've chronicled both of them well, is that I've always felt, from what I've heard about it, that basketball is kind of a solace for them. It was both a way out, but also just kind of a way to that they got meaning and enjoyment in their life. And Giannis did not have that relationship with basketball growing up, which you would think, by the way that he plays and the joy and the instinct, that it very well could be that. Instead, it comes from this other angle, and it seems like he's, to a degree, finding that a little bit later in life, which is fascinating.
I think that's right. And I don't even know, when I see him, he comes across as, in the anecdotes about him, and especially early in his career, he comes across as joyful. I don't know that I would describe him as a joyful player. I actually think he plays a little angry. And, you know, I think that some of those anecdotes and depictions of him and the joy he had when he first came over, I think that was largely a result of being young, of being successful, of being here in the United States, of succeeding, of having money, of all of that. I don't know that his association with the game is so much about the joy. I think at this point it's about the work. You know, when I look at him, I actually see somebody more on, you know, more on that kind of Westbrook, Kobe, LeBron side of the ledger than I would, you know, more of that kind of warrior school, which is more obviously the joyful way of approaching the game. And I don't mean to, like, it's not black and white. I don't know if you can have a kind of a line of demarcation there. But I see a guy who's playing with a fury, I guess. I mean, and that's what's so unusual about him is you look at that build and you just don't see players who, you know, he plays almost like a, like with the spirit of a little guy, you know, when he's coming down the floor. But I think what really amazed me about, and speaks to, I think, the point you just made, is how you can see the floor and have sort of that sort of vision and feel for the game without really growing up in the game, without kind of having that be just a part of your life. I mean, you're not talking about somebody who was watching this on TV. He liked Iverson a lot. It's kind of funny, like Porzingis, he had the cornrows, like, you know, like Iverson when he was young. He did like that, but it's not like this was somebody who was immersed in it, who was, you know, studying YouTube videos all the time like Porzingis did. I mean, Porzingis was really immersed in the NBA life, even though he wasn't close to it. Giannis was not. So how you can see the floor, feel the game, because that, the people who saw him in Greece, that's what they talk about. They talk about kind of the way that he could feel the game. And that's amazing to me, because that, with that, I've always thought that that came from experience, immersion, being around it. And what it makes me wonder is maybe that's just a natural gift. Maybe that's just something that is really hard to quantify, really hard to measure, but it's just there in you the same way. I mean, the comparison you keep getting when you're in Milwaukee is that it's like Jason Kidd, the way he saw the game, the way he felt the game, but clearly they're totally different. I mean, Kidd was probably running a team when he was 5 years old. Giannis wasn't running one until he was 17.
It's fascinating, and it could just be, again, with the idea that it's just special, is that when you're dealing with anomalies of anomalies, you're not going to get enough of a sample size to really know how far it can go. And also, a lot of times, a player with Giannis's background is never even going to get the chance, but because he grew so much, not only before he joined the NBA, but after, that he got the chance to really pull this off.
Yeah, and I mean, it always goes back to that, right? Like, we can talk about, well, the work somebody puts in and the solace they take from basketball and how they use it as a refuge. And I think all of that's true. I think you need all of that. You need the passion for it. You need the work. But it all, at the end of the day, it comes back to those physical gifts that we're talking about, Durant and LeBron and him. Someone who's, Embiid was like this too. Embiid was somebody who, you know, he tried to sit there and tell me with a straight face earlier this year that he was going to play volleyball, that that was what was going to happen for him unless he had gone to this one camp that Luke Richard and Bamute hosted, and Luke found him and kind of created this path for him to the NBA. And before that, he was going to be a volleyball player. But it's a little hard to believe, and same way with Giannis. I just have to believe somebody was going to find this guy. I mean, there just aren't that many people walking around the earth who look like this. And when you look like that, you're obviously so geared to playing this one sport. I mean, the arms, the hands, the length, it's like he was born to do this. He was wired to do this in much the same way Durant and LeBron were. And it feels like more and more, and maybe I'm just naive, but it feels like there are just more guys like this who sort of have this. I mean, when you talk about Porzingis, I know people call them, I guess, unicorn is the popular phrase, but just so many of these stretchy giants right now. It's the term I use in the story, for lack of a better one. And those people are probably pretty easy to discover, no matter where they are.
As long as they find the game first. And I guess maybe that's the logic of it. It's thinking back to Tim Duncan. You know, there's the story about Tim Duncan finding the game after one of the Hurricanes knocked out the pool in the Virgin Islands where he grew up. So I guess that's a part of it, is just knowing that it is a possibility, because if you grew up in Cameroon or you grew up in Greece, if you don't find the game first, I don't think the game can find you. Like, at that certain point, just because the base of skills that you need, but it is possible because the pressure to develop it all the time. But I was thinking back on the growth spurt idea. It also happens on the smaller side. Russell Westbrook relied on a growth spurt to become the player that he was. I remember, because I was, you know, around that, his junior year of high school, I think he grew a couple inches, and that's what helped make him an NBA player. So it can happen all over the court. And these individuals, whether they're small or whether they're taller, are such special physical specimens. And I like the idea, of stretchy giants because it ties in with one of the things that I think is going to make the NBA such a watchable product moving forward, is that the league was forcing itself into a very difficult choice because they were playing less skilled big men, especially physical skill, mental skill, all that kind of stuff, off the floor. You see that with the way the Warriors play five out, various teams. Even Cleveland has done a really nice job of that, even though they play big dudes. Giannis, Porzingis, Karl Anthony Towns, Joel Embiid, if there are enough of those guys, if we're getting closer to a critical mass, they prevent us from having to make that choice because
they're small ball playing big, or big guys playing small.
Small, and so then you create a watchable product. Because you basically take out this constraint that didn't exist. I mean, there weren't human beings that could do this very often 20 years ago. I mean, you think back on how special, you know, basically any guy with some size that could handle the ball. And a lot of those guys, like Charles Barkley, you know, Charles Barkley is a phenomenal player, Hall of Famer, everything like that. He's probably like 6'5". I mean, 6'4", 6'5". And you think about what these guys are doing, not saying they're better players or anything like that, but just it's changing the possibilities in the league in a way that is coming along at the right time. And I firmly believe that the teams that were leading this, whoever you want to give that credit to, Don Nelson, whoever, they didn't see this coming. It just happened.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost like we've morphed from small ball to this big small ball, which is really just athletic ball. I mean, I feel like in that Warriors Thunder series last year, you started to hear this more. Like, we'll play small ball with 7-footers. I think that was the quote. I can't remember. I think somebody gave me that quote. I think it might have been Adams or somebody like that. We'll play small ball with 7-footers. And that's sort of what they were doing. And that feels like when you watch the Bucks, that feels like where they're headed with Parker, with Baker, if he could develop, with Giannis. That seems to be the way the game's going. That might be, I don't know if that was a response to the Warriors and going back to D'Antoni's Suns and the Rockets and everything like that, but it clearly does seem like the way the game's going. I still don't think we're going to get to a critical mass where every team employs several of those guys, just because I don't know how many of those people are really out there, but clearly those are highly the most valuable assets, it seems like, right now. And it's funny to me with this point guard thing. I mean, clearly we were heading in this direction. It's so odd that the guy who would be doing it would be the guy from Greece who didn't play really until he was 16. But, you know, you always heard, whenever I did these stories about big guys, you'd always hear, oh, well, he started out as a point guard. And that goes back to Pau Gasol. You know, I remember writing a story about him, and they said he started as a point guard. And then Towns started as a point guard. And Durant, they felt, could play point guard. And Anthony Davis, of course, used to be a point guard. But when they got to the NBA and the rubber really met the road, they didn't actually play point guard. Porzingis, same way. And now with Giannis, the fact that we're seeing it probably opens a whole lot of possibilities because of this, you know, kid said it pretty well, this idea that your window is just higher. You're looking through a higher window, which gives you a better view of the floor. It gives you more options, more places to put the ball.
LeBron is also a template for that. I mean, LeBron is the best passer in the league. He's tall. He's just working on the toolbox. And what we could see as a big ripple effect of Giannis and LeBron, and to a lesser degree, though he's an amazing player, James Harden, is the idea that these skills, while a lot of it is innate and you're never going to reach the level that that Giannis has so far, much less where he's going to be, without a lot of that God-given physical talent, is that a lot of the pieces of the skill set, having a solid handle, looking in the court, being a willing passer, and then eventually adding to, I call it the passing toolbox, just the idea of, you know, having bounce passes, having a bunch of different things to get the ball where you need it to get to. Those skills are useful in the NBA now, whatever position you play. Draymond Green is a great example of this. Like, Draymond Green is not a point guard, if we're using the term the way people used it to describe Magic Johnson. The ball is not in his hand. He does initiate sometimes, but the ball is not in his hands all the time. But that ability has made Draymond Green an all-star. Like, Draymond Green would have been second place defensive player of the year the last 2 years, but what has made him the second best player before Durant on one of the best teams of all time is his ability to have these other things on top of it. And there is a reward structure in place for all that. And I mean, we'll see what happens with Jabari too. I think Jabari's handle is getting better. He's never going to be the passer Giannis is, but he can do a lot better there. And it helps make a career for players, especially guys who have an unreliable jump shot. So my hope, one of my big organizing hopes of basketball, is that players with that kind of a skill set, with those sorts of deficiencies, especially if they play cerebrally at a young age, just work a lot on dribbling and passing.
Well, it seems like that's going to be kind of the legacy of this era and this Warriors team, and is that you do, there's this emphasis on, I suppose the word would be versatility, on both ends, the ability to guard multiple positions, the ability to play make, pass, and it seems like most of the players we're talking about have that, and you know, it's that, maybe it's part of LeBron's legacy also, that's sort of what the archetype of the modern basketball star is, and so many of these guys, look, I don't know exactly how it is in AAU and when they're growing up, but I assume, you know, like in baseball, you always put your best player at shortstop. It feels like we're getting to a point where when they're growing up, the best player's playing point guard and has the ball in his hands all the time. I mean, that's where we are with Harden, right? Is he's just going to play point guard because he's the best player they have and he can do the most of these things, even though you might not have cast him as a point guard traditionally. And so if that's the way grassroots basketball goes, where the best players playing point guard, they're going to be developing these skills early on. And this should there should be a snowball effect here. And I don't think that – I think Draymond Green's a big part of it. I feel like everybody will want – you know, it's like you look at the Lakers right now. They've got these young guys. I don't know that they have a point guard. You know, I don't know necessarily that Russell's a point guard. Obviously, Randall's not a point guard. But, like, we're talking about guys who can play make and who can pass – and still they might not have actually found their point guard. And that's okay. I think in the past you would have looked at that and said, well, that could be a big problem. Well, maybe not. Maybe it'll help them that all those players are so versatile down the road.
It also provides a lot of defensive value because if you can get that skill set from somebody who defends a different position, then you can ask for something different. It isn't the circumstance where before there was this world of players who don't have the ability, just like so many, to run an offense, but are 6'2", 6'1". And so those players had to either play out of position at the two, like Monte Ellis is a good example of this, or not make the league at all. And there are a lot of players that can really benefit. Or you can do the more interesting thing if you have physical capability of just not playing somebody with traditional point guard size at all and just having a more versatile switch-heavy lineup. And there aren't enough players, as you said. There isn't a critical mass to make every team possible, but there is enough of a mass, depending on how you approach it. The Sixers could end up being this.
Yeah.
Build a team where, you know, that can check every box, and nobody in the starting lineup is shorter than 6'5".
Yeah, I mean, Simmons be like this?
Absolutely.
Have a similar effect as Giannis?
Simmons is a better passer and has better court vision last year than Giannis has now. Like, Giannis is a physical freak in a different way. Like, the way that he moves on the court is different than Simmons. But as a passer, as a distributor, Simmons was special. He's special for special. Like, I mean, I think Nate and I talked about when we both watched a lot of film of Ben, is that he's one of the best passers for his size since LeBron. Maybe the best since LeBron coming into the league. And that's something that you get better at, but you don't, in terms of court vision, generally speaking, it's pretty close to baked in the cake. I think about a guy like Sean Livingston, who always had that back when he was playing at Peoria. It's a lot of the same story, and Simmons is that. But Simmons is not the physical, the Embiid. Well, Embiid's different too. We'll talk about him in a second. But Embiid, Towns, or Anthony Davis, where those guys just physically, like, they move like they're smaller and also play like they're smaller. Simmons is a little bit different, but he's amazing.
But I mean, if he can fill the role that Giannis is playing right now, is that what you expect him to do? Is basically function as their point guard?
Yes, that is what I expect, especially in transition. I think he's going to be their best transition decision maker. So maybe he ends up offensively. He ends up as a better post up 6'9" Ricky Rubio. And think about what that means from strategic implications. If you could get that in a guy who plays the four or the three, depending on how you want to bounce it around, it's so much more valuable than having it as a one.
Yeah, I love how the game kind of has these corrections to it. Like, a year ago, it felt like if your point guard couldn't shoot from outside, you know, couldn't burn anybody who went under on the screen, that he was kind of almost obsolete. And now here we are a year later, and while obviously outside shooting is as much of a premium as ever, we're talking about a guy who's shooting sub 30% from three as being potentially the new point guard archetype. And another guy who I assume will be shooting sub 30% from three being kind of the next one. So the corrections the game makes, even in a very short time, are kind of amusing and probably a good reality check.
And you're dealing with these players that are special and also that derive so much inspiration from each other, even while they're in the league. I mean, there was that piece, part of the Giannis one, about how he, working in the arena, how the reason he started doing that was because he watched Chris Paul do it.
Well, especially this guy. I mean, you're somebody who comes over, is completely, he's a totally blank slate. So he's looking at guys, you know, I kind of referenced it in the story, but like he'll be looking at guys doing the handshakes, you know, the crazy handshakes. He's like, well, what's that? I need a handshake. You know, and it's everything. It's all the kind of little trapping, superficial or otherwise, of NBA players. Yeah, well, Chris Paul's shooting after the game after a tough loss. Maybe I should do that. You know, you can see it sometimes in the ways he acts on the court. Like a little of it seems contrived. Like sometimes after he scores, he'll flex and he'll sort of scowl at the camera. And it seems a little bit put on when you realize what his past is and that he didn't really come up in that world. So I think a lot of it is just him watching TV, watching other guys, trying to find his way and figure out, you know, what's cool, what's part of this, what sort of, how do superstars really act? I think that's where he is right now. I think he's sort of trying on some different personas, some different, you know, sort of behavioral things and figuring out what fits for him. And I don't necessarily know that he's even there yet, but whatever he's doing is clearly working because, you know, you've seen this incredible leap, and I don't even know that he knows what's totally natural yet.
That's a great point, and I want to take a quick moment to talk about the new sponsor of Real Jam Radio, ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter is something that I have dealt with from the potential employee side and was really impressed with their interface. I dealt with them a couple of years ago when I was looking for a job. Thankfully, I haven't been in that market recently, but it was absolutely one of the first places I would go, and I'm excited because the way that they're talking to us about it is actually from the employer side, which is great because one of the challenges of being an employer at this point is that it's hard to find quality candidates and to really look everywhere at once. And ZipRecruiter is a way to do that because you can post your job to 200 plus job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, with a single click. And that allows you to find candidates in any city or industry nationwide. You post it, and you wait for the qualified candidates to roll in. You can screen it however you like. You can rate them, and you can hire the right person fast. So it allows you to look a lot of different places at once, filter through it, find the right person. And that's exactly why ZipRecruiter has been used by more than a million businesses, which is really impressive. And since it's the new year, it's a great chance to make those moves that you're looking for. And it's also a great time because if you use the custom URL ZipRecruiter.com/sportsfan, you can post jobs for free. So that way you can check out ZipRecruiter, see if you enjoy the product, if it works for you. I fully expect that you will. And no financial risk whatsoever. You can try it out, post your job to 200 plus job sites, and check it out. Again, that is ZipRecruiter.com/sportsfan. ZipRecruiter.com/sportsfan. Check out ZipRecruiter, and you can try it for free. Now back to the conversation with Lee Jenkins. Something that I found fascinating about the current generation of young stars and almost stars is that this is the first group of players that grew up in an era where it is basically understood that at least once they become famous, we will know a lot more about them. And there are many generations of players where that would be a really bad thing, where, you know, various, they had vices, they had all sorts of other stuff. But when you look at Joel Embiid, I mean, you wrote a great story on him. You think about what he's done with social media and everything else. Karl Anthony Towns has his own story. There's also a nice piece by Mark Spears today about his connection to the Dominican Republic. And you see all these guys, and, well, I'm not saying they're perfect individuals because none of us are. It is amazing how ready a lot of them are for that close-up at such a young age.
Yeah, you're right. It's a good point. Even Porzingis. And they all kind of came about it in different ways. Like Porzingis and probably Towns, although I'm not as sure, I don't know him as well, they were trained for it. Like Porzingis's brothers, specifically his older brother, trained him for this. I mean, they learn English. They would go over what interviews should sound like. I think they had an idea, or he had an idea of kind of, you know, his public presentation and disposition early on. He's a very charming guy. The league is really lucky. I mean, so many of these young players, not all of them, but most of them I've met, they seem very capable and very eager to sort of assume this mantle. And when you're around other sports and you're around young players and even past NBA players who are young, they really don't. They seem sort of reluctant to do it. So the NBA is lucky in that regard, and some of them are prepared. I don't think Embiid was prepared. I think for him it came naturally just because he's so smart, and I think he has pretty good perspective on things and realizes that so much of this is silly and fun, and he can have fun with it. And I think he sort of – I think it helps him in a way. I think he likes sort of engaging with the world in a way. I think Giannis is similar, although I think as he gets older, you'll see him withdraw a bit. I don't really know that he will be quite as eager as somebody like Embiid or maybe even Porzingis to take it on. Although, you know, when you get to sit with him and you have a little bit of time with him, he unlocks pretty quickly. Like, he's one of those guys who I think is probably a little bit reluctant, but there's just so much there. And, you know, there's a lot underneath the shell.
Yeah, you used the word closed in a couple of points in the piece, which is interesting, but also it ties in with, you know, how his background is, but also how uniformly Giannis has been accepted in Milwaukee, I think it could be a pathway to him opening up and having that. But I could totally see him, with the limited amount I know, also being somebody who keeps elements of his personal life personal. And there are guys who do that all the time. And What I find maybe most interesting about the idea of these young guys coming in and being polished is that I expect that from people like Steph Curry, who I've covered his whole career,
right?
Because his dad's an NBA player. He knew exactly what the expectations were. Kobe Bryant, you know, dad played all over Europe. He had a wealth of life experience that prepared him for being a star like we haven't really seen before. And, you know, eventually if LeBron's kid or Chris Paul's kid end up being good enough to make the pros, who knows? They'll have that in a way that even those guys didn't, because of how their parents have navigated this world. That's not true for a lot of these guys. I mean, the players that are especially this younger generation, they have a connection to the game in some form, but they don't have that experience with the NBA. However, because the NBA is more open now, I think they had a better sense of it going in than a lot of people did.
I think their polish is different than Kobe's or Curry's. I think there's still sort of a rawness to it, and honestly, I think it's pretty genuine. I mean, I think when you talk to any of these guys, these young guys, I think you're seeing the real deal. But listen, a lot of them have been pretty well known, Giannis obviously being an exception, for a long time. I mean, Towns, I think when you go to Kentucky, you pick up some things there. I mean, Towns is clearly a top prospect early on. You know, when you talk to D'Angelo Russell, and I know he's not in this class, but I think he's, you know, because he's of the same generation, he's instructive. There's a feeling like he's done this a lot. Like he's, you know, he's been known for a while. But there's also, a lot of these guys are in this wonderful time where there's still some rawness to it, but there's also kind of a knowledge of what's expected. And I think the NBA has done a nice job with this, is various ways letting players know that this is part of the job. This is part of it, is you put yourself out there a little bit. You're the face of the league. It's a stars league. And I think the NBA will reap dividends with this going down the road with this generation, potentially with the next generation, that your story is part of the league story, and telling that story and embracing it is part of promoting the overall good of the game. And I think the NBA, clearly that's been the business model for generations. And I think it's a model that will still serve them well, especially as baseball and the NFL struggle with those exact same issues.
And there are a couple reasons why it helps in the NBA. One is also that the NBA has a growing acceptance that all stories are interesting and have a resonance. Like, you know, you can have the players that are the sons of NBA stars and the ones who come from whatever upbringing, and all of those have it. But also the degree to which basketball is not a helmet league. It's one where the individuals are very much at the forefront, and how few players actually make it. You know, this isn't like baseball where you have, if you're going to tell those stories, you have 27 or 40 of when they expand the rosters. When you have that many people on their roster, or football where it's, you know, I think NFL is like 55 right now. Basketball, it's 12, 15, but really it's 7, 8. And
yeah, isn't that amazing? Yeah.
That's a very different thing. And so it opens it up in a way that actually makes sense to telling these stories. And the NBA has also, there's now like a really good industry now around telling these stories. There are talented people in positions like yours and also on the television side who realize that this is how some people connect with the game and connect with it. And I think back to, you know, I'm somebody who did not grow up watching much basketball. You know, I watched the NCAA tournament and all that. And part of how my parents have connected with the sport after I started covering it. It was long, long after I got into it, was through those individual things, because it's a way that it's a way for you to see it in a different way and then appreciate those players. And so for it goes in a lot of those directions. And now we understand that those stories can really work. And we happen to have it at the time when the players are ready to be open about it and to tell it, because there's a time, I'm sure, that a player like Giannis wouldn't want to talk about how he had hustled outside the Acropolis. But now, you know, that's a great part of his image.
Well, for a casual fan, I think it's probably harder to connect or to understand sort of the technical aspect of the game more than it is to relate to just a person. And I know some of these guys are sort of superhuman, but there's still a human element that I think is relatable, and that people can kind of say, oh, I know that guy. That's the guy who had this happen. That's the guy whose life story kind of looked like this. And maybe it was totally different than your own, probably, but there's still sort of a spark there, a connection there. And I think that it's not just the stories and the TV companies and the commercials. It's also the teams themselves. You see situations like Harden, for instance, where the coach comes in and essentially the entire team, the entire system is focused around this one guy. I mean, he is the sun and the moon there, and everything is about him. And so it becomes another snowball effect where everything is James Harden. If you're a Rockets fan, you're a James Harden fan. If you're a James Harden fan, you're a Rockets fan. I'm kind of amazed sometimes when when these stories come out, just how the deep connection that fans have to these players, especially fans of the team, but even fans of other teams, where you don't really see that as much in other sports. I feel like it's way more provincial. It's way more, you know, if you're a Patriots fan, I mean, maybe Brady's a different example, but there's so many football teams where it's like, it's only the fan of that team necessarily will like that player. And so much of the storyline is about the salary cap and, you know, what free agent can the team get and, you know, what kind of trade is there. Whereas in the NBA, I mean, I've said this before, but I think the names on the back of the jersey still count, because those star players are still so much a part of those teams. I realize there's more player movement and that's a source of a lot of consternation, but the player movement is nowhere near what it is in baseball or what it was in the NFL. I mean, could you imagine it? Like the Durant thing caused obviously a ton of uproar, but like Dexter Fowler, this guy for the Cubs, who's, you know, part of them winning the, you know, World Series for the first time in forever, a few weeks after the World Series, he just goes to the Cardinals. He just goes to their arch rival, signs with them. Jason Hayward last year did the other thing the opposite way. There's just this constant movement that I think makes the identification with a superstar a little tougher.
We'll get right back to the podcast in a minute, but I want to take a quick word to tell you about a superstar in the listening enjoyment universe, which is our friends at Audible. Audible is offering Real GM Radio listeners a free audiobook with a 30-day trial membership. You just go to audible.com/try now and you can browse their unparalleled selection of audiobooks, original audio shows, news, comedy, and so much more from some of the leading audiobook publishers, broadcasters, entertainers, and so much more. One of my personal favorites is comedy, because it's really great material, and it's often narrated, especially in Audible's case, by the person who actually wrote it. So these are talented comedians like Jim Gaffigan, Tina Fey, the late, great George Carlin, and it's them doing their own material, so it's really great. But you don't have to take my word for it. They have a wealth of other options, depending on what you're interested in. And they have a great selection of kids' books, including the whole Harry Potter series and Charlotte's Web. But really, any genre you're interested in, they have a great selection. And audiobooks are a great way to kind of fit in with the rest of your life, because it can be more persistent. It can be just a part of everything else, whether that be on your commute or doing daily activities, or, you know, if you're doing housework or anything like that, and that you can continue on with the story is a really, really great thing. So if you're interested in this, you can check out their amazing selection. You go to audible.com/try now. That's TRYNOW. And you get a free audiobook with a 30-day trial membership, so you can see for yourself. Now back to the show. And football in particular has, I don't know if it's deliberately, but has kind of tried to use fantasy and DFS to take advantage of that a little bit, just because it makes players care or makes fans care more about the individual. But in basketball, it's a lot easier because the teams take on the personality of their best player.
That's right. Yeah.
And so you kind of have to have that element. And they're also different that you find what you like, you find what you don't like, and so you're going to follow that. And League Pass is not the end-all be-all, because there are a lot of people who follow the sport, and there are a lot of people who follow the sport intently who don't have it. But it is a very easy way, if you're a basketball fan, to make those sorts of connections early. And I've had this great frustration with the league that they've been so reluctant to put their smaller, particularly smaller market talents on national television. Like basically the idea that Giannis is a cult figure at this point, like Kevin Durant was at this point in his career,
yeah,
is immensely frustrating to me from a business standpoint. But it does lead to this experience of discovery where sometimes people and the general sports population, you were talking about that issue with the Giannis piece, find a player at a time when maybe their game and their image and everything else is a little bit more ready for that kind of attention and adulation.
Yeah. You should say that last part again, that Giannis would be more ready for it.
Well, yeah, I think he is. You know, if the sports population in general had been watching him as breathlessly as I have for the last 3-4 years, it might be a little bit different. Like, I think that process has been immensely rewarding and fulfilling, but he's so much closer to an actualized version of himself,
right,
from a basketball perspective, that it all ties in together relatively well.
I think for him, look, you probably saw it coming, and people who were really in it probably did. I don't know that the league and the TV companies and his 15th overall pick, I don't know if it was as easy to see coming as, let's say, Durant, where everybody kind of knew in advance. And I'm sure that they'll have – and listen, to get to that point where you can transcend the market size probably takes – there are only a few people who have been able to do that. You know, Anthony Davis, I suppose, is sort of there, or at least close to that. Durant, I mean, that to me is kind of – the everlasting impact of that Thunder team. That's kind of what they did, is they, I think, showed that you could do it anywhere, that you could kind of, there were no limits despite market size. And I think that's something that Durant will probably always be recognized for and get credit for. And I have a feeling that going forward, the Bucks could be that team. I mean, I think it's been kind of interesting that everybody's sort of looking for the next Thunder. You know, who's that team going to be, that young team that sort of comes up, you know, takes those necessary steps and gets there. And it felt like Utah was a popular pick going back. It was New Orleans. Then Minnesota this year was the team that's supposed to be that. And listen, you watch this stuff more closely than I do, obviously, Danny, but it feels to me like Milwaukee could be that team, that they could be the next Thunder. And especially since they get to be in the East and they get the benefit of that. I don't know if a team in the East, I know Boston has a lot of assets, but this team has one superstar, potentially, I mean, probably a second star already on that team. You know, you look at Middleton coming back. I know people have always said, well, it'll be tough to get free agents in Milwaukee. I don't know. I think that at this point, that team is now a pretty desirable destination. And looking ahead long term, they look to me like the second most relevant team in the East.
They definitely have a great case, not only because they have a star in Giannis, but they also have, they put him in the right place to succeed, and a lot of the other pieces they have make sense with that theory. I like to use the term like a theory of the team, or like a concept of it and how it's going to work. And even though Milwaukee doesn't have every piece yet, it all makes sense. And we didn't think that was going to work with Giannis and Jabari, because both of them have trouble shooting. Jabari got better. Giannis got the ball in his hands. That all works. Middleton is great as a secondary, tertiary guy. That's what he was always kind of meant to do.
Yeah.
So that fits in. The other two teams, I would say, that are in that conversation beyond Minnesota, which is its own thing, would be Boston, just because of the assets they have, and the Sixers. And the Sixers are nebulous. It's the future. They're like what the Wolves were 2 years ago, where it's like, oh, well, they have all this talent. We'll see how it works out. You can't say definitively it's going to work with them, especially considering one of their best players has not set foot on NBA 4 yet. But they have the tools, and I won't get too far into the weeds here, but what might end up changing it is something that I obsessed over a year and a half ago, which is that they have this unprotected pick from the Kings coming in a couple years. And if the Sixers start blowing up around that point and the Kings fall off, they could end up just adding another top five pick. The parallel would be to what the Pistons nearly did when the Pistons added...
Right, with Mel Darko.
With,
yeah,
Darko, where they added another guy who was going to be that. Darko ended up, you know, being Darko.
Of course.
But that
could have been Carmelo.
Yeah, it could have been Melo, could have been D-Wade, and maybe they're going to get that possibility. And in some ways, that might be the most reasonable way to replicate the Thunder, because what the Thunder did is they were just they were so bad those first couple of years that they were able to add more really good pieces. They also, Presti and the group, nailed those picks, but they were able to add more quality in three drafts. And the best way to do that is actually not to do it in three drafts, it's to do it in four or five and get lucky by having good picks later on. And so, because
the Thunder had three, but they never missed,
and Ibaka too. Ibaka's another important
Ibaka
one.
Ibaka, too.
They get him in the 20s, give him a little bit of time while the team still sucks, and it works out. And so that situation, it's almost impossible for Lightning to strike twice in that, because in basketball, having a good player makes you good too fast. But the Sixers, you know, it's not like in baseball where, like, a baseball team also doesn't matter as much, but, like, they can have the number one pick in the draft, like, 4 years in a row, and then all of a sudden it's like, oh, crap, they're actually good now. That's what happened to the Cubs.
And the Rays and the Astros.
Exactly. Yeah. So that can happen in that sport. But in basketball, if you draft LeBron James, if you draft Karl Anthony Towns, you're not going to be bad enough to get the next Karl Anthony Towns for the most part, unless you get really lucky like the Wolves did. The Sixers might be able to do that. It's an outside chance. We don't know yet. But that would be the way that it can happen. And Philly is fascinating if they reach that because of their weird relationship with major markets just due to proximity.
That's what the Thunder basically did, right? They had Durant, they had Westbrook too, and they still started 3-29, which underlines how difficult it is for young teams and probably should provide solace for the Wolves right now. But that seems like the model. It's like you get those players, you get those big-time players, but you're still able to get one more on top of it. And clearly it didn't work for them, and now they're going to have an enviable position of possibly having the top three in the MVP all from Oklahoma City, all with Oklahoma City ties. But that seems like the roadmap.
It does. And we'll see how that works out moving forward, just with a lot of other things. But one thing I wanted to get back to, we talked about a little earlier, and it was a point that we got on other viable topics, was one of the lessons of Giannis and LeBron and all of these guys is an idea that holds a lot of power for me, which is teaching big men how to be big men is a very hard thing. There are very few individuals in this world that can do it well. So maybe the lesson here is to train all these talented guys to be guards, and then if they want to learn big man stuff on top of it, they can watch tape like Joel Embiid did.
And they can become Hakeem instead.
Yeah, if they want to. Like, you just give them all the base, and then if they want to build on top of that, so be it.
Yeah, I don't know if it's as much if they want to as to just where those talents lead them. I think that's the best thing about basketball, about the NBA, is that either through the player or through coaches, people who work with them, they're able to recognize sort of, well, what do you do well? And we're going to put you in position to do what you do well. You know, for some reason, this wasn't Jabari Parker's game. This wasn't his destiny. It was more to be to be a more traditional power forward, whereas this was more of Giannis's skill set. Somebody has to recognize in him this ability to kind of see the game and see the floor and handle the ball. And I think it's always going to be unusual, just for pure physics, for people who are 6'11", 7 foot, to be able to do that. And it's going to take probably creative coaches to hand them the ball. I think that what they're proving, what Ben Simmons will prove too, is that it's worth a shot. You know, it's definitely worth time. It's worth looking at that. The question will be, is what's more valuable? Like, what's more valuable moving forward? Is it somebody like Giannis who can have the ball all the time? And is that what you sort of want your bigs to do? Or would you rather them play out of the post? To me, to play more inside and learn how to, you know, shoot the corner three and all of that, because I think that's kind of going to become a more of a grassroots question. But to turn them all into point guards could be missing the point. I mean, this guy is obviously very special, and the league and college basketball and grassroots basketball is still pumping out ridiculous point guards who are 6'3", you know, at an alarming rate. I mean, a couple of years ago, that's what I think we all were talking about, where it was Curry and it was Lillard and Rose and Westbrook, and the list kind of went on, and it still does. I mean, those are still 90% of the game's great point guards are still little guys who
that's
can
true.
Shoot.
Yeah, that's a great point. I think the other part of the reason that I like the kind of the guard school, at least at a younger age, is that if we're talking about the people, AAU and everything like that, who coach 14-year-olds, they can coach guard stuff a lot better, also because a lot of them were guards. And so I'm not saying make it uniform. And also, there needs to be a distinction. And I think this is coming. There are two other big points with this. Is one, the separation between offense and defense. Like, I still think defensive principles, I also like the idea of everyone knowing how to do everything, but learning how to be, you know, be a defender for your size, for your position, how to fight the guys who do play in the post, everything like that is still extremely important. And then the other one that I think is going to start becoming a big differentiator that isn't that hard, but it takes some work, is getting better at setting screens. Because if particularly Porzingis, like if he gets a little bit better at that, he can benefit. And one of the lessons that if I ever had the ear of a prominent high school AAU coach that I would tell them is, tell these big dudes that if they're good at setting screens, it's going to create more looks for them. Because if you're a good pick and pop big, the better screen you set, the more open shots you're going to get because the other team has to scramble. And when they scramble, you're going to get the ball.
Will that come as more of those college teams, high school teams, as they play more like the NBA plays, as they run more pick and roll? Because I remember, like, maybe a few years ago when Will Lillard was coming out of college, I remember I did a story just about preponderance of pick and rolls, kind of a, you know, not exactly a novel idea, but I based it around Lillard because Weber State ran just a ton of pick and rolls, and they did it with an eye on Lillard's NBA future and getting him just a really accustomed to running that play over and over and over again. And I think it benefited him a lot because I know that when teams worked him out, they felt as though he was NBA ready. And part of the reason he was NBA ready is that he was a master of the pick and roll coming out of college. And I remember hearing at the time that some other of the point guards were not, that other teams didn't necessarily do as much of that, didn't set as many ball screens. Are you seeing like more of that at the grassroots level?
A little bit, not all the way yet, just because it can be hard to teach and teach well, but there's a natural evolution of it just because of that idea of that the more foundational it becomes in the process, the easier it is to do. Also, it can be a fun style to play for particularly for point guards, but for other guys, because a pick and roll, I think back to, you know, the Warriors are a basis of a lot of my experience, but the Warriors offense, which it doesn't actually involve that much pick and roll because it's an overstated part of it, but the philosophies of ball movement and player movement, which are becoming a little bit more prevalent, it's fun for everybody. You know, it's a great product to watch, but it's also enjoyable for the players because you know that if you work hard, you can get the ball, and if you work through punishing the player who doesn't give the open player the ball, it can actually work reasonably well to encourage the type of behavior that not only creates a watchable product, but also creates a winning system because we're seeing those teams do well.
Yeah, so whenever I've asked guys about screen setting and where they learn that and pick that up, it always seems to be at the NBA level. It always seems to be from, you know, and a lot of times it's from point guards. It's from guys like Chris Paul and Nash, sort of. I mean, Nash, I think, was an expert at this, at telling his big guys sort of the angle he thought he wanted the screen set and the way they wanted you to come off. But I always feel like when people talk about that, it's a very NBA-specific skill, kind of like the corner three used to be. I remember, I don't think I ever wrote it, but I started working on a story about the corner three a couple years ago, and you had all these guys who said, yeah, I never shot a corner three. I never worked on that before I got to the NBA. So it was like it was an NBA-specific thing. And I don't know if it still is. I don't cover college and high school basketball enough to know. But at the time, it was, and I felt like screen setting, maybe not to the same extent as the corner three, but it fell into kind of a similar category.
It makes some sense, and we're seeing players that do that. I'm trying to remember. Draymond Green has done, and he talked one time about screen setting and where he did it. I think he picked it up a little bit in college, but of course he was in college when a lot of guys are in the NBA, just because he had a 4-year career. But he's also proof, and so is Stephen Curry, that you don't have to be big to be a good screener. I mean, it helps. You just, if you have a big body that people have to go around, but angles, timing, effort, all those things are really big factors in it. And point guards can be also, we're learning through a couple of these different teams, that point guards can sometimes be the most effective screeners out there because it comes out of nowhere.
That's Lillard screening from McCollum?
Yeah, or Curry for Klay Thompson, those sorts of things. I mean, it's not the same type of thing. It's not like a high pick and roll, but that gets into the idea, which is one of my big concepts of the league, is that as we move towards this idea of these bigger guys that can run an offense, whether we're calling them point guards
or
not.
Right.
If you can get guards that screen, if you can run, let's do it by defensive position. So if you can run a 4-2 pick and roll, all of a sudden, you've got a universe of things that are open to you that weren't before. The biggest one being you can generate switches in the opposite way. And so instead of having to do, you know, the point guard dribbles around and then passes it to the four that has the point guard on him now, you can do it the other way. And so all of a sudden you have the matchup you want and you don't have to make the pass. So you do that. Let's say you run a 4-2 with Simmons and whoever they get at the two. If that guy can set a decent screen, Simmons can just start backing that dude down. And so a lot of those guys have decent back-to-the-basket games. This is actually another guy who's like this is Nikola Jokic. Jokic has a good back-to-the-basket game, but it works a whole lot better against guys that are smaller than he is. And maybe that's the way that you resolve the post-game struggles is by just making sure that you don't have big-on-big post-ups like what happened in the game that the Tuesday night. There were a series of entertaining but altogether fruitless post-ups with Towns and Embiid. It's like, that's not, I don't think that's where the future of post-ups is. I think it's big versus small, and then the other team has to scramble for help, and if that guy is like Ben Simmons or Giannis or whoever, they're already big enough to know how to pass out of it.
Which is another reason why that big point guard just gives you such an advantage, because you're running, is what you're saying, because you're running, like, if you've got LeBron and he's setting the screen or coming off the screen, either way, you're more likely to attract a complete physical mismatch.
Everyone's a physical mismatch for LeBron.
Well, you know what I'm saying.
Yeah,
or
I do.
Or Giannis, or
yeah,
any
I do.
Of these guys.
Yeah, exactly. And LeBron is actually probably the best example of this because he's so good at attacking whatever the weakness that presents itself is. He's still, you know, the jump shot is still something else, but LeBron has reached this point where he can figure out like how the chess pieces are going to go and also be able to make that thing happen without necessarily having to rely on somebody else unless it's a play that revolves multiple passes. And that's part of how Cleveland is this amazing three-point shooting team.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Anything else you want to discuss?
No, I'm good. I'm good. I've gotten to see your alma mater a little bit recently.
So
they've got some good, they've got some pretty intriguing players.
They do, and Lonzo is someone who fits into this in another way where I don't know exactly what he's going to be as an NBA player, and I feel like there a part of this is giving him short shrift because we should appreciate Ball for what he is in college.
Yeah.
But it's going to be fun.
Is he a top five player? Top five pick?
Probably. This is a weird draft. I don't think there's some things that have had him like top three. I'm not totally sure of that at this point because what he doesn't do at a elite level is create separation. He does almost everything else well, except for that crazy ass jump shot. But he doesn't, I'm not completely sold on that yet. You know, like, so if he gets that little window on a screen, he can use it, but can he like take his guy off the dribble and force help and then make the pass? He can make the pass. We know that.
He doesn't have that elite quickness.
Right. And that's been part of the issue for D'Angelo Russell is that Russell, right. He can make the pass, but he can't create the separation. And so that will be a lingering question with him at this point. But if that's all he needs, there's a certain possibility that he can because he's just so crazy good at lots of the other parts. And also, an underrated part of this whole thing is I think we're moving towards a little bit more in transition decision making just because teams are realizing that running just works. And so Lonzo is, even if he can't generate that in the half court, in transition, he's going to be one of the most dangerous players in the league right away. And
what's his defining skill? Just vision, decision-making?
Decision-making. The ball never sticks with him. So if he gets, I've been consistently impressed with him going back to the limited amount I watched of him at Chino Hills, that it feels like he always does the right thing with the ball. Mm-hmm. And that is just a core characteristic. It's not always indicative of a star. You know, there are lots of players that haven't had the physical capability to make that into a thing, but it is also a common characteristic of a lot of the best players. I mean, that was something I always thought about. What part of the reason that I gravitated towards LeBron over some of the other players of his generation was that I felt that way with him. And an underrated player who does that a lot, not every time, is Wade. Like, Wade is a very intuitive passer and makes a lot of those good decisions, also a very instinctive defensive player. So Lonzo does a lot of that, and it appears that it's done by instinct, though that kid has so many reps that you never know exactly for sure.
It's funny, because that Chino Hills team, I always thought the word on them was that they played not reckless, but kind of fast, and I never saw them. That was always kind of what I'd heard about them. And then you saw this guy show up at UCLA, and he was so controlled. I mean, he just seems so far beyond his years, and that's why I think they're I mean, look, I don't know if he's going to be a great defender or not. I'm not sure where you'd put him in terms of that, but I haven't seen a college team this fun offensively in a long time.
I'm going to make an analogy that might come out of left field, but I hope that it's going to resonate with you, and if not with you, with listeners, is that there is this thing. I'm not super knowledgeable about poker, but one part of it that I do know is that one of the big changes that happened is that you had these guys that had grown up and played in poker rooms and all of that, and they had the experience of, you know, you play as many hands as you can do. And what happened is this group of people came from online where you can play so many hands at once and you can deal with all these different circumstances. Playing the funhouse mirror that is Chino Hills, where you basically just drive down like 7 seconds or less, basically shooting mm-hmm. that, it gives these guys so many more reps that I, especially more reps in transition, that it works in a different way in terms of preparing them. And so it might just be also that, but I think when I watch ball, I don't see a player who does that out of experience. I see it as more something that it's just what's in him.
It's instinct. Yeah.
Well, it's been an absolute pleasure as always. Keep up the great work and I'll be excited to keep reading it.
Thanks, Danny. Appreciate you having me.
Thanks again to Lee Jenkins for taking the time to come on. You can, of course, read him at Sports Illustrated, and you can follow him on Twitter at @SI_LeeJenkins, SI_LEEJENKINS. Absolutely love talking with Lee. So appreciative of him taking the time, and lots of good material to go into. I actually wanted to talk a little bit more about Joel Embiid, but we never really found a through line to get our way back. Embiid's a fascinating figure, and Lee wrote a nice piece on him, I think right at the start of the season, that was really good. Honestly, you should read everything that he does. It's spectacular. And we didn't even talk much about Durant to the Warriors, which is surprising because we probably could have done a whole thing on that. But I love reading him, love talking with him. It was a real pleasure. Also, already have the next episode of Real Jam Radio recorded. Some of you might have noticed this. It was a little bit weird on Twitter because of just the timing of how this happened. I recorded the monthly tiers column, so it comes out generally in the first week of the new month with Ben Golliver, also of Sports Illustrated. We did that on Tuesday afternoon, but I wanted to get the Lee podcast out a little bit more quickly because the Giannis piece is still doing really well, and because the tiers are pretty stable at this point. You know, an injury could change it, but I think that can be inferred by context and everything else like that. So the tentative idea is to put that out over the weekend, give this a little bit of time to breathe, and then we'll see where things go from there. I am open to input on this and all things, so you can reach out to me. It's been a blast to be able to kind of have these opportunities to reach out to Lee Jenkins and say, hey, do you want to come on, and have him say yes. And I'm so appreciative of him for taking the time, appreciative of Real GM for giving this opportunity. And it's great to be part of the CLNS Radio family. You can listen to this and many other great podcasts on the CLNS Radio app, which you can download in whatever app store you have. I believe they're in everything at this moment. If you want to support the show, you can do so by leaving a rating, leaving a review, telling your friends, giving, you know, subscribing, downloading every episode. And depending on how this goes, you know, the episodes will probably always be a little bit sporadic. So subscribing is definitely the best way to do that. And as always, one of the best ways to support the show is by checking out our sponsors. This episode, the inaugural episode of ZipRecruiter, you can go to ziprecruiter.com/sportsfan and post jobs for free, which is great. And also Audible, you can go to audible.com/try now. And you can get a free audiobook with your free subscription. I actually invoked it in the podcast out of the blue, but Trevor Noah's book, Born a Crime, is absolutely excellent. I finished it yesterday. Spectacular. And he tells it himself. I really did highly recommend that. And Audible, because it is the platform for that. I believe that one was made with Audible Studios. So awesome that they did that. Lots going on. Going to talk about the league. And the other part of input is, if there's a topic area or a team or something that you think would benefit from the deep dive that I like to do with Real Jam Radio, let me know. I always have ideas, I always have plans and trying to line people up, but that input helps. You know, if you're thinking they're saying this is underreported or whatever is going with that, I will listen to it. I might not always follow the advice, but I will always listen. So thanks for taking the time to listen. Take care and make it a great day.